I think we should be educating our...
Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison. Great to have her along, and thank you so much for joining us today. Questions for her, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. And if you want to post a picture of your pet on my Facebook page, we'd love that as well. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. And Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be back. You know, I should post a picture of one of my dogs. I have two small ponds in my backyard, you know, just a little like 4 feet deep ones. And we got them all set up. And I guess Bulldozer, when we weren't home, decided to jump in, go for a swim and come out and then roll in the mud. And I have on my own personal Facebook page a picture of him. I should put it on here. I took three baths to get all the mud off of him. Welcome to spring, you know. So,
well, you know, speaking of dogs, last time someone asked about dogs' tasting ability.
And I promised that I would look it up because I didn't have the information at the tip of my tongue. And you'll understand why I use that phrase, because all of dogs' taste buds are all at the tip of their tongue. So one of the things that I was always thinking is, like, you know, you give a dog a chunk of steak and you would think that, you know, when we eat something, like I put a piece of chocolate in my mouth, I would just sit there and let it savor. And, you know, you don't just like swallow it whole. But you give dogs something that they obviously love. And what do they do? Just down it. Okay. And it's like, well, aren't you tasting it? Well, it turns out that they can taste the same things we do, bitter, sweet, salty, and sour. But it's at 1/6 the ability of us. So we have a much better taste of sense of taste. They have a very good sense of smell. So they've already got their enjoyment out of smelling that steak that you're holding in front of their nose. And so why bother spending the time with it in my mouth? I'm just going to swallow it. So I just thought that was really interesting, that they probably use their sense of smell much more than their sense of taste. So I hope I answered the listener's question. If I didn't, have them call me back.
And Walmart and Sam's Club, this is a whole different thing here. They're now selling their own brands of heartworm preventative. It's called Pet Trust Plus.
Yes.
Any reason to think that just because they're discount stores, they aren't good quality?
No. And this is something that consumers need to be aware of, is that you can get, although it's a prescription drug, and you will still need to go to your veterinarian, and you'll still need to have your pet weighed, perhaps a heartworm check done. You know, it is something that you can talk with your veterinarian about. The one that they're carrying is a similar version to the one that most people have heard of, called HeartGuard. And HeartGuard is a beefy chewable cube that has ivermectin and pyrantel, same ingredients in this one. So it's going to do the same thing. In fact, there's several other products that do the same thing. There's Iverheart Plus, there's TriHeart Plus, and so on, that you can get through other, if your veterinarian doesn't carry it, on other online pharmacies. And so if cost is an issue, that would be another place to be looking. But what I want people to realize is that not all heartworm preventatives are created equal. All of them are tweaked a little bit differently. So this one class, the ivermectin pyrantel, is great. Gets heartworms, roundworms, and hookworms. But perhaps you live in an area where whipworms are a problem. So your veterinarian may say, you know what, I would rather have you use a product like Interceptor or Sentinel, which is very similar but has a flea control agent in it. So it's still important that you talk to your veterinarian and find out what would be the best heartworm preventative for your pet. If they do happen to mention ivermectin pyrantel combination, then say, you know, I want to get my dog's teeth cleaned, and if I can save some money on my prescription, would that be okay? So I think it's fine. They've just realized that there's a market out there, and welcome to the business world. I know it's ticking a lot of veterinarians off, but I think we need to kind of get our head out of the sand and realize that we can't corner the market on drugs.
There you go. There's a new study, and we got lots of callers, and we'll get to that in just a minute, but I was really interested in this new study that says flame retardants can be linked to hyperthyroidism in cats.
This was a study that just recently came out of the University of Illinois. And, you know, we have flame retardants, and they're called PBDEs, polybromated diphenyl ethers, okay? And they're in our furniture, in our carpets, in some clothing, and pretty much everywhere. And so here we have our cats, and this stuff gets into our house dust, and it's right down on our level, and they're grooming it off themselves and so on. But they looked at 62 domestic cats that were household pets, and they looked at 10 feral cats, and they found that, you know, outdoor cats that aren't exposed to this kind of stuff, that definitely the indoor cats had really, really high levels of this chemical in their system. And when they started looking at, because they know that this particular group of chemicals, these flame retardants, are what are called endocrine disruptors. They tend to cause issues with our hormonal systems, not only in pets, but potentially in people as well. But cats are kind of like the canary in the coal mine, because they're down there on that level. They're probably more exposed, licking it off. And they found that cats that are hyperthyroid are living in homes that have much higher levels than your average cat and average home. So just something to be thinking about. And they interviewed one person here who said that their cat, who was hyperthyroid, they went in and they checked his house, and he had 95 micrograms per gram of dust. And after a lot of cleaning, replacing, you know, toxic furniture and so on, he happily got it down to 3 milligrams per gram of dust within a 3-year period of time. So it's another one of those things.
Wow.
We still don't know what causes it, but, you know, it's just something to be aware of when you're buying furniture and having your cat share your life.
Boy, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Didn't know. Ron in Clam Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
How you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. We have a 13-year-old kitty who's just a wonderful family pet that has a cataract on his left eye. And the vet has tested the kitty for blood sugar and determined that it's not caused by diabetes. And so we're and has really recommended not to get it removed, at least at this point.
Now, yeah.
I got to back up and tell you that the cat only has one eye, has lost its left eye, or right eye, to an injury.
Okay.
A cat. We have 4 cats, and we think the cats got into it, and the eye got infected. We tried to save it, and that was a year ago.
So, okay.
So Eddie only has one eye.
Well, you know, when we see cats with 2 eyes and 1 eye with a cataract, we typically think that it's probably traumatic in nature, because if it was something affecting the whole body, like diabetes, then we usually would see both eyes being affected, because diabetes is one of the causes of cataracts. So I'm glad your veterinarian looked, and I was wondering why they jumped to that conclusion, but with not having the other eye there, I can see why they did.
Yeah.
Kudos for your veterinarian. But removing a cataract in a cat is not something that is easily done. Their eyes are very different than human and dog eyes. And I'm trying to put on my kind of pseudo-ophthalmology hat, and I'm probably the ophthalmologists at the vet school are listening to me going, oh, don't say that. But from my understanding, it's just the lens is so firmly attached in there that you just can't get it out without causing a lot of damage to the eye. Versus in humans and dogs, they can do a procedure called phaco emulsification, where they go in and just kind of like ultrasonically vibrate the lens into a liquid form and suck it out and replace it with a regular, or, you know, an artificial lens. So that's probably why your veterinarian's saying don't remove it, because chance of your cat having a good eye that's visual afterwards, it would be pretty slim. So I'd just be watching right now. There's lots of stuff online on how to live with blind pets. It's basically you don't want to startle them. I'd maybe put unique bells on the other cats so that they can hear them coming. So they're not going to, you know, your blind cat won't be startled.
Right. They do all 4 have turkey bells.
Okay.
Which our vet finds surprising.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we can hear them when they're out, because they're indoor, outdoor.
Yeah, and this kitty that's blind really should be kept inside, because obviously the neighborhood dog or anything like that is probably not wearing a bell to warn them that they're approaching. So I'd be keeping the blind cat inside. Easy access to the litter boxes. Make sure that you've got a house of plenty where you're not going to be running into troubles with the kitty having to maneuver up and down stairs to get down to the litter box. And by having unique bells on the other cats, then they may be able to know which housemate is approaching. And same for you. I'm not saying you wear a bell, but make sure that you make a sound or something to announce your presence for your cats so that they know that you're coming. They do make, at least they do for dogs, and I don't know if it's sized down small enough for cats, but a little collar that has like a little minor, little vibrator attached to it. And you could probably, well, I hate to say what even store to go into, but you could probably come up with something on your own where you have a little remote control and you can trigger it and it just makes a little bzzz, and so the cat just feels this vibration on its neck, and that way it knows you're coming as well. So for deaf animals that works really well, but for visual, you know, for blind animals, you definitely can just make some noise.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I'm going to give Susan in Coon Valley a chance next. Hi, Susan.
Excuse me. Good morning. Maybe Dr. Sawchuk can give me another avenue here. I have a lab shepherd cross, and she's worm. She's in good health. She gets plenty of exercise. But here's the issue. She is just continually licks her vulva area, and we've had all kinds of urinalysis done on her. Diabetes has been ruled out. Diabetes insipidus has been ruled out. The concentration of her urine has been checked 2-3 times. And what I'm looking at, you know, is this a habit? Is there something else going on that we should be looking at? I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, you've gone through some medical workup to rule out, is there an actual urinary tract infection or a urinary problem where she's drinking more water? Few things that I've seen where female dogs will spend a lot of time licking at their perivulvar area. One would be is if they're incontinent. It's very common for spayed female dogs, especially if they're carrying a little extra weight and as they start going up in years, to have a weaker bladder sphincter. And so whenever they lay down, a few drops of urine will leak out, and that sometimes triggers them to lick. So be on the lookout for like wet spots where she's laying down. If that's the case, then getting her incontinence treated. And there's a couple of different things that we can do, either using estrogen or a drug called Proin or phenylpropanolamine. One of the other reasons we'll see this too is sometimes they'll get skin irritation around their vulva. Anatomically, there are some female dogs that have what we call a recessed vulva, where there's a big hood of skin coming over it. And so you've got skin on skin contact. I just had a dog in the other day. Same thing. The owner's just saying licks and licks and licks all the time. Didn't look like there was anything really wrong. The hair was slightly stained. It wasn't red or raw. But I just took a glass slide and put it up to the skin in that area and did some impression smears. And she had a nasty yeast infection on her skin. And yeast infections are itchy. We treat the yeast. And guess what? Her itching went away. But, you know, and so it's, you know, so I think maybe asking your veterinarian to do some cytology on the skin might help you with finding out what's going on. And then you being the investigator to watch for little puddles when she's sleeping.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest here, Dave Potratz, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Connie and Portage up next with a question. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have an old cat. The vet says that we brought in from outside. Somebody threw him out, and we felt so sorry for him. We brought him in for the winter. And I took him to the vet because he was sneezing all the time and had some drainage from his nose.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he had a virus. So we put him on an antibiotic and gave him like a nutritional supplement. And then it went away, but it keeps coming back. And I'm worried that my other cats will get it. I heard one other cat sneeze, and I thought, oh, Lord, I hope not.
Okay. Well, when you said your veterinarian thought your cat had a virus,
yeah.
Viruses are by far one of the more common reasons why we see chronic sneezing in cats. They're the typical virus that can, you know, cats will pick it up when they're young kittens is one called rhinotracheitis. It's cat herpes. And periodically, they can end up having, you know, it come back again and they'll have recurrent upper respiratory type problems. But sometimes just even back years ago, if they had a nasty virus, there can be enough damage done to the filtrating bones, what are called the turbinates in the bone, in the nose, that that makes them more predisposed to developing infections, secondary infections, usually with bacteria. And that's probably why your veterinarian opted to put your cat on an antibiotic, because my guess is the discharge was probably green or yellowy in color. And so they said, yeah, well, let's clear up the infection. And they put, I would have guessed that the supplement that they put your kitty on was called taurine. What taurine is it's an amino acid that we know helps stop viral replication. It helps inhibit the, especially herpes. And so it's something that you can have your cat on chronically if they're herpes carriers and can and potentially keep getting recurrences. So the question is this a recurrence of the herpes, or is it prior damage it's already done? Or is there something else going on? Being an older cat, do they have a nasal tumor? Do they have a foreign body up their nose where they were sniffing down close to the ground and got a grass seed or something up there? So your options are keep, you know, periodically retreating to keep your cat comfortable. Or what I say, go through the nasal extravaganza, which means testing for immunosuppressive diseases like feline leukemia and FIV. I hope that was done before this cat was merged in your household.
Yeah,
getting a CT scan done of the skull. That you, taking an X-ray just doesn't give you clear enough view, but a CT scan does. And that has to be done under anesthesia because cats don't want to sit still in a CT scanner. And so it would mean some pre-anesthetic lab work to make sure that the kitty's healthy. Once they get that back, if they see something in there, then the next step is usually rhinoscopy, going up with a scope, not only through the nostrils, obviously a very tiny scope, but also through the mouth and up over the soft palate and looking at the back of the nasal passages and seeing what they can see. At that point, if they find something, taking biopsies, if not, doing cultures and getting cytology. Sometimes they'll just flush everything out. And sometimes for some cats, just doing therapeutic nasal flushing, put them under anesthesia and just, you know, run a bunch of saline through their nose to kind of like us using a neti potty pot just to clean everything out of their nasal passages. So you can see it's a pretty involved process to get to that point. But your question, are your cats going to be at risk? If they're current on their vaccinations, unlikely. All cats, just like all people, sneeze once in a while. It's our natural response if we've got a little irritation up our nose. But if your cats were exposed to herpes as youngsters, vaccine is not going to prevent them from getting it back again. It may decrease the symptoms, but if they're stressed with the addition of another cat, they may have a recurrence of that infection, just like our herpes comes back to haunt us whenever we're stressed.
There you go. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had an interesting on Facebook question from Kim, or comment. She says, I have a question that sounds crazy, but I find myself thinking about it a lot. Our wonderful senior cat is a beloved member of our family. We adopted her from the Humane Society. Is it wrong that she has spent her entire life since then in the 6 rooms of our house? Seeing us come and go, smelling the fresh air, seeing the animals outside, but never having the experience of freedom.
Oh, you know, and this is kind of a little bit of an ethical dilemma. And I think the fact that your cat is a senior is testament to the fact that you have kept your cat in a safe environment. I read somewhere that the life expectancy of indoor-outdoor cats is closer to 7 to 8 years. And this is a kitty that's 15, so if she was an indoor-outdoor cat, especially indoor-outdoor without supervision, you know, she could have gotten into trouble with getting into fights, injured, and so on. You know, boy, you can give your cat such an enriched environment indoors with cat trees, and it sounds like they, you know, if they can see animals through the window, you know, and they've got screens where the cat can sit and look out and see the fresh air. The cat sounds like it's quite happy. If, you know, in the future you want to get another cat, you want it to be an indoor-outdoor cat, a couple of things. One would be make sure you discuss it with your veterinarian because the preventative care program is going to vary compared to an indoor cat. We need to think about heartworm, intestinal parasites, flea and tick control, other vaccines of diseases that tend to be transmitted by stray cats that your indoor cat probably would not be getting. One kind of happy medium kind of solution is there's a fencing system called the, I think it's called the Perfect Fence, P-U-R-R, like the cat purr. And it's a portable, like a mesh type system that can go up in just about anybody's backyard to provide your cat with an outside area. They even have like outdoor kitty run type things, which are little tubes that they can go in. But again, that's not going to prevent them from picking up parasites and fleas and so on. So you still need to be addressing those things with your veterinarian. But yeah, it's a dilemma. But I think the cat sounds very happy.
Does to me. Tom, also on Facebook, wonders what you think of the new treatment for hyperthyroid cats that involves feeding a prescription low iodine food. Is that effective?
Okay. Yes. The hyperthyroidism in kitties typically is either treated with radioactive iodine or using a drug called methimazole or tapazole that blocks the thyroid hormone effect. But this new diet came out by Hills, and it's given the name YD. Why, I don't know, because I think it's the second letter in hyperthyroidism, but I think they just ran out of letters for all their different therapeutic diets that they have. It's an extremely iodine-restricted diet. It has to be made in under like really, really strict conditions. So everything, like the plant has to be pretty well shut down, totally cleaned out to make this food, because just a smidgen of iodine can trigger, you know, the cat, keep the hyperthyroidism going. So it is expensive. And when we started looking at the cost of this diet compared to medication, methimazole, it's actually cheaper to use methimazole than this diet. You can't give any other food. They can't get a treat. They can't get a smidgen of human food. They can't get milk. They can't, you know, nothing. They get this food and only this food and nothing else. It's a really a high carbohydrate, protein restricted diet as well. And when I start looking at the numbers, I get a little concerned, because I know cats are carnivores and they do better on a higher protein diet. So I don't know what this is going to do in the long run to cats. They've done a lot of good studies. It's out there. But at the veterinary school, we are still kind of saying we're not going to be the first kid on the block to be trying this. If someone came in with a single cat and had this, the cat couldn't tolerate the medication, then this may be something to consider trying. But I'm still a little skeptical about long-term use.
All right. And one more Facebook before we go back to the phones. Alexandra says the heartworm medicine that kills whipworms, that'd be Interceptor, is no longer available. What do you recommend?
Well, it is going to be available. Unfortunately, they had some manufacturing glitches with, I guess, pill fracturing or something. And so it's, you know, short term, we don't have it available. I know in our clinic, we have the small dog size still available, but none of the large dog size, because we've used it all up. There is another product that is similar to this called Sentinel. It is Interceptor with another product called Lufenuron, which is an oral chitin synthesis inhibitor. It stops fleas from being able to make their crunchy pits, and so they don't develop. And so that would be another alternative to consider using in the short term.
Bridget in Sand Creek, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I actually have a question about my 5-year-old pit bull has allergies, and we've kind of narrowed it down to food allergies.
Okay.
And I started him on, well, this has probably been 5 months now, he's been on a homemade diet.
Okay.
And I was wondering if I tell you kind of what the diet is, if you could kind of give me advice as to me being concerned if he's getting enough calcium.
That would be something that a nutritionist would, you need to use a nutritionist. And there are several veterinary nutritionists around where you can send them their diet. For me to just look at it, there's no way. There's no way I can tell from just, you just visibly, you know, verbally telling me. But by you know, a veterinary nutritionist would be able to look at all the ingredients that you're using. You know, if your dog has food allergies, it's usually to a protein source for the in the diet. And I would be, you know, wondering, what are you using? I mean, just that's what I'm curious about. What did you find that works for your dog?
I switched to just chicken, dark and white, and rice, brown and white rice.
Okay.
And a combination of green beans, carrots, and sweet potatoes, and within probably a month and a half, he was not having any more breakouts.
Good.
Breakouts developed in his paws.
Yeah.
And he's been on it now with no problems for 5 months.
And so what I heard just there is that there is no multivitamin supplement and there's no mineral supplement. And so that's what you need to do is find the right amount of supplement to be able to add to that diet.
Okay.
You know, some of the diets that are out there that you'll see, they'll say, you know, use bones and so on. But how digestible are the bones? Is it going to be a problem for the dog chewing them and swallowing them? So, you know, finding a good supplement. One that a website that I'd recommend that you go to is, there's two, the American College of Veterinary Nutritionists, I believe is what it is. You can go to that one, and then they have a list of different, you know, nutritionists that would be able to help you, that are board certified veterinary nutritionists. They've done, you know, more training after veterinary school to, you know, develop that specialty. And there's another one that is out in California that's called balanceit.com. All one word, balance it. And they actually sell a supplement that is, you know, can be put in with the food. But again, you have to know the, you know, how much food you're using to supplement to be able to get the right amount for the dog. And you can, for a fee, get a recipe. And so what you could do is go on there. And I don't know if they give you like one free recipe, but you could enter your basic ingredients, you know, the chicken and the rice, and then say, you know, balance it for me. And, you know, they will do that. And you can get your supplements and so on from them as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Dolores in Kenosha, hello.
Oh, hello. Good morning. I have a 14-year-old cat, female cat, and several months ago, she's was throwing up every time she ate. Then she just stopped eating and drinking, and we called the vet. You know, didn't let it go on for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, more than a couple of days, and they said she had pancreatitis.
Mm-hmm.
And we she got something for the nausea, which stopped the vomiting, and then she got fluids there, and they showed me how to do it, so I did fluids for the next, you know, 5 days.
Okay.
And she's been fine since, but where does pancreatitis come in a cat? You know, I am a nurse, and I know where what usually causes stuff like that in adults. But
yeah. Well, we see pancreatitis in dogs and cats, but even in between dogs and cats, it presents very differently. So most dog patients come in vomiting, severe GI pain, you know, and it can sometimes be mild to so severe that it ends up with death. The pancreas, as you know, but maybe the listeners don't, is an organ that's very closely adhered to the upper part of the small intestine, and it secretes digestive enzymes. And so when it becomes inflamed, it starts releasing these digestive enzymes, and so it sets up a huge inflammatory response. In cats, pancreatitis can become a very kind of smoldering chronic problem, and sometimes you'll see some liver involvement with it, and you know, but it can present very, very differently with just maybe a little nausea, a little weight loss, decreased appetite, and that may be all it is. So it's, you know, there's lots of different presentations, but it's you know, we don't know the trigger for cats. We know for dogs, it's often a high-fat meal. So the dog gets into the trash and eats a bunch of pork chop fat or gravy. That can trigger it. But for cats, we really don't know what the trigger of it is. But often these cats have to be on like a low-fat diet, a low-residue diet. They may need to be on intermittent pain medication, anti-nausea drugs. So it's kind of the symptoms are treated rather than the disease itself.
Okay, so she's on an overweight management veterinary diet.
Okay, mm-hmm.
And we always have fresh water here. So yeah, I just kind of wondered. Occasionally, I give her kitty treats.
Okay,
but they're the standard.
Yeah. Yeah. But I would just avoid, you know, dumping a bunch of gravy on her food or something like that.
Okay. Thanks, Dolores. Wanda in Clam Lake, your turn. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. Yes, I have a Pomeranian, a teddy bear, black teddy bear Pomeranian.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, well, I noticed it a while back, and he's got water fluid in his ears. When you pet him and you touch on his ears, you can hear it squish inside his ears.
Wow.
And I did put peroxide. It was like a couple drops, and it seems to have dried it up, but now it's come back. Is that what I should be doing, or do you have any other suggestions?
Well, I'd probably want to, I mean, it's the standard answer. You need to take your dog to the veterinarian. Fluid doesn't belong in there. Peroxide, putting that in the ear can burn and can be quite irritating. Dogs have a very different shaped ear canal than we do. Ours goes in straight, so we just turn our head on our side and anything that's in our ear is going to drain out. Dogs have a kind of a J-shaped ear canal where it can pool in the bottom. And I've seen owners that have been using peroxide actually denude the entire lining of the pet's ear canal. So be careful with using that. If you are going to use it, make it dilute. But even with that, I'd say get a diagnosis. So if you were to come in,
and I don't mean to interrupt. What I do is when I do put the drops in, I will rub it and work it in. And then I take a Q-tip and just lightly, put a Q-tip in to try to suck up any of that.
Yeah, but, even that, you should be flushing it. It needs to be flushed out. Leaving that in there can cause irritation. So you've been lucky so far. But, what I would be doing is, if you were in to see me, is doing the same thing, putting a Q-tip in the ear, spreading that stuff out on a slide and seeing what's there. Are there bacteria? Are there yeast? Is it a combination of things? Are there parasites like ear mites? And having a good look down in there with an otoscope to see, do we have an intact eardrum or do we have a middle ear infection? I really think rather than just trying to medicate at home, there shouldn't be squishy sounds like that in there. So get that looked into before it turns into something really serious.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Bill in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi. No, I feel like I just came. Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 14-year-old cat myself, like the other gal who called a little earlier. And I noticed in the last couple of years when she gets her checkup, we're given the blood panel, and sometimes her the kidney functions, I don't know, was a creatinine or something like that. Sometimes they're higher, sometimes they're lower than the previous time. And so I'm assuming there's some kind of a kidney function or problem there, and I'm wondering what would be the best way to go with that. The doctor's prescribed this Hill Science Diet KD food, but I'm wondering, because also I missed part of your conversation last month about that. You also said you had some information that's on something called Iris.
Yes. There's a really good website that, in fact, I just went to it today. Took a student over because they were like, "Oh, look at this, lab works normal," and I'm like, "Huh? Let's have a look and let's go over to this website and compare." IRIS stands for International Renal Interest Society, and it's iris/kidney.com. And it's has lots of information on kidney disease in cats. To diagnose kidney disease, you really need to have a couple of things. One is a urine sample and the other is a blood sample, so that you can do a comparison of, is your kitty able to concentrate its urine? Are they spilling any extra protein in their urine? Probably more common in dogs than cats. And then we compare that to the BUN and creatinine level, which are a couple of the kidney values that will be elevated when kidneys start to fail. And what this IRIS system is it's just a grading system so that we can classify pets in different stages of kidney disease. And it lets us know kind of how what we have to do to be monitoring them more frequently if things are starting to look a little bit worse. But my way of monitoring cats with kidney disease is, besides checking urine and blood, I also like to check blood pressure. Many pets that have kidney disease will also be hypertensive, which can aggravate the kidney disease. When we have just early changes, I tend to like to introduce a renal diet, and there's several of them on the market. KD isn't the only one on the market, and some cats love KD. Other cats would rather have multi-stage renal by a different company or NF by Nestle Purina. So lots of ones out there, and you can get prescription diets online through online pharmacies too if your veterinarian doesn't carry the one that you happen to think that your cat may like. So when I send a cat home with these diets, I'll give them a little goodie bag of all kinds of, you know, cans and little bags of the dry and say, tell me what your cat likes. And then we try to introduce that slowly so that they get used to it. Lots and lots of water, water, water everywhere with kitty water fountains, dishes. Keep your kitty hydrated, you know, and obviously lots of litter boxes because they're going to be going to the bathroom more frequently. And watch for urinary tract infections as well, since they tend to be more prone to those. So those are kind of the big things that we watch. And, you know, if the cat's stable, rechecking lab work every, you know, 4 to 6 months and making adjustments to what we do from that point on.
There you go. You mentioned the little kitty fountains, and we have one, and our cats love that fountain.
I know. I was just visiting a friend the other day who bought a decorative one for her kitchen, and she said, the heck with it being decorative, my cats love it, you know, and so she's got it all rigged with a chair next to it so the cats can go up and drink out of it. My concern is that, you know, it was made for decoration. Is there lead in it? Is it appropriate? Yeah. You know, can you clean it the right way? So I'm
ours is stainless steel, I think.
Yeah, so I convinced her that she, you know, if her cats like it that much, get them their own water fountain that you can wash out and clean and filter the water.
Yeah, makes sense. Shannon in Madison, hi.
Hi, Larry. First, before I ask my question, Dr. Sandy, I called last month and I want to say thank you. My cat was throwing up bile, and you suggested feeding him closer to bedtime, and so far that seems to work.
Good.
You haven't had any problems. Yesterday, he was diagnosed with his first urinary tract infection.
Okay.
He was given Cosequin and Baytril, and I'm supposed to mix it in with wet food. He normally eats dry food.
Okay.
He gets about a table. They said to mix it in with about a table or a teaspoon of wet food, and he's only eating about a quarter of that.
Oh, okay.
So I know then he's not getting the medicine. Do you have any tips on how I can get him to...
Well, first of all, how old is your cat?
He's 13.
14, okay. And how was this urinary tract infection diagnosed?
They, urinalysis.
Urinalysis. Did they culture the urine to find out what the actual bug was and the appropriate antibiotic?
That I don't know.
Okay. You know, your cat's kind of in that gray zone. Cats under 10, when we see blood in their urine, less than 2% of cats under 10 actually have a urinary tract infection where there's bacteria there. Many, many cats, probably the more common thing that we see that causes blood in their urine is where they get what's called sterile cystitis. We get our stomach gets upset when we're nervous and stressed and so on. For cats, their bladder is their stress organ. And so it's usually associated with stressful events. And, you know, 5 to 7 days later, they're usually back to normal. So typically we just treat them with pain control and lots of, you know, maybe give them some fluids and send them on their way. And we usually don't do anything. But, you know, your cat's in that zone of being 14. Is there, you know, so why would your cat have a urinary tract infection? And so either they've got underlying kidney disease where the urine's more dilute and they don't have that natural protection mechanism. They have a bladder stone that could be causing something like that. So I think it might be time to, you know, call your veterinarian and say, you know, I'm having a hard time getting this down them. Is the antibiotic really necessary? Did you actually see bacteria? And sometimes we see things that look like bacteria on the urine, and yet we culture it and don't grow anything. So did they culture the urine, and what are they growing? What would be the appropriate antibiotic? Because there are other ways of getting antibiotics into cats. There's injectable forms that can, there's one that lasts for 2 weeks that may be very appropriate. And so I think, you know, rather than trying to struggle to get this medication into your cat, go back to your veterinarian and ask those questions because you need that information. You know, it's unfortunate that you didn't get it. The other question I would have is, why would they put your cat on Cosequin? That's a glucosamine chondroitin sulfate supplement typically used for joints, for joint control, for cats that are and dogs that are arthritic. I know that there are some veterinarians that will dispense it for cats that have this sterile cystitis. And so if your veterinarian is using that, maybe in their mind they think this might be sterile cystitis, then you don't need the antibiotics. So it seems like a weird combination. So I'd go back there and knock on their door and say, help me wrap my head around what's going on with my cat.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Larry Mueller here. Just to mention that in early July, I'll be leading a group of WPR listeners to London to tour English gardens and attend the Hampton Court Flower Show, and we'll visit some of England's great churches and houses along with their gardens. So really looking forward to it. We've have lots of people signed up already, but still some opportunities. I think there's four or five at least more open spots, so you could still get in. We'll be seeing the cathedrals at Leeds and Canterbury, visiting the famous White Garden at Sackville West, and the Rudyard Kipling's retreat, Bateman's House. And then, of course, an entire day on the grounds of the Hampton Court Flower Show. It's the world's largest. It's run by the Royal Horticultural Society. And we're getting a private tour of the Secret Gardens of London. Those are just a few of the highlights, and I hope you'll check out the whole itinerary at wpr.org/travel. So go to wpr.org/travel. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it. July 1st through the 9th.
Well, Larry, I would love to go, but I have to work. So, yeah, but enjoy. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What does a 12-pound Yorkshire Terrier and a 218-pound woman have in common?
I have no idea.
They're both overweight, okay? Oh. You know, there's a really cool website called PetObesityPrevention.com, and they have on there a weight comparison chart so that you can look at your particular breed of dog, kind of what they should weigh, and then it compares it to the average human being. And so it's kind of an eye-opener so that if someone comes in and I say their lab is 20 pounds overweight, you know, that is like, you know, saying that, you know, they're 240 pounds or whatever. So it's 20 pounds doesn't sound like much, but when you put it in human terms, it's like, wow, they're really heavy. And especially for little dogs, little Yorkies and things, like a couple of pounds can make a huge difference. So that's a great site for people to go to and do a little, pet weight comparison.
And what is it again? It's
PetObesityPrevention.com.
There we go. Eric in Madison has a question for you, Sandy. Hi, Eric.
Yes.
What can we do for you?
I have a two-part question.
Okay.
First, we have a couple cats, and clean the litter boxes religiously. They get cleaned out every day, and then once a week I dump them and put new stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
I have a laundry basket that sits about 10 feet from the litter boxes, and I have one cat that will always urinate in my laundry basket.
Ooh, okay.
Huh. We've had the cat in, had a urinalysis, and had blood tests. Everything came back normal. But I have noticed, let's say I got a black pair of jeans in there or something, and pees on that, I noticed that the urine is kind of sparkly.
Yeah, what those sparkles in quotation marks are actually crystals. It can be normal for cats. Cats produce, young cats especially, healthy cats without kidney disease, produce such concentrated urine that has mineral material in it that when it is voided and drops down to room temperature and just sits for a little bit or starts to dry up, those crystals come out of solution, and that's what you're seeing on your jeans. So if your veterinarian has done a urinalysis and has not found any big issues, looked for bladder stones and things like that, then this just may be normal cat urine. So when we are trying to check a cat to see, you know, are these crystals that we're seeing in the urine significant? We like to get a urine sample hot off the press and have a look at it right away before it has a chance to just come down to room temperature. So it's real important to check it before the things come out of solution. But the big question is, why is your cat going in this laundry basket? And, you know, I've done this multiple times, but I'm going to go through it again, kind of my rules of litter box management. And it sounds like you're cleaning it every day, scooping. And that's great. The things that we'd be looking at is numbers of litter boxes. There should be one for every cat in the household, plus an extra one. And so if, you know, we like to have them in different locations too. So perhaps if the laundry basket is something that is a, in a convenient spot, put that away and put a litter box that's an open pan right there and see if the cat would use it. We also like to look at what's in the litter box. Sometimes we put liners in. Cats don't like them. Sometimes we'll use types of cat litter that cats don't appreciate, like the some of the least appreciated litters are the wheat-based litters and the crystal litters that are kind of the silica crystals. It looks like rock salt. It's very rough on their feet, and they don't like it. The ones that are like the best tend to be the soft, scoopable, sandy litters, preferably unscented, but there's even some controversy as to whether scent makes a big difference too. And then the litter boxes should be uncovered. Are your boxes covered or uncovered?
They're all covered. They're deep boxes.
Yeah.
Because I have problems with them digging and throwing litter out.
Yeah. And so, you know, I equate a covered box to a porta potty on a hot summer day. You know, you get in there and it's like you don't want to touch anything, and it's like, you know. So they tend to be very confining for a cat. Litter boxes should be about 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to rear end. So they need to be big. But your cat may just not like to be confined. And so that's why they've picked the laundry basket being an open pan.
I'm thinking the roughness on the feet.
Depending on what you're, if you're using regular clay litter, that
I'm using oil dry. It's the same as kitty litter, just a little thrown.
Yeah, but it's coarse litter, okay? And they don't like that on their feet. Plus, you can't scoop out the urine, and so by the end of the week, you've got the fecal material out of there, but the urine is still in there, and you've got all this ammonia inside those covered litter boxes. So go to one of the scoopable, soft, sandy litters. The other thing you can do is, and I will just go in my exam rooms when people are like, I don't want to, my cats kick litter everywhere. I'm like, well, make a homemade litter box for them. So a few things to look at. One would be the cement mixing trays. They're huge. They cost about $3. You can get them at home improvement stores. They're heavy duty plastic. They work really well. I'll have some people put one of those on top of one of those trays that a washing machine will go on, same store, but again, they can kick the litter out and it's all confined to a tray. Do you know what I'm talking about? Those rectangular trays with about a 1-inch side. If you just Google homemade litter boxes for cats, you'll see a whole bunch of them where they've taken storage bins, thrown the top away so it's not covered, and then cut a doorway in it so that you've taken a chunk from the top down so that it's got sides that are, you know, a foot high or so all the way around. So when the cat does kick, the litter doesn't get out and it's just got this doorway. That makes wonderful litter boxes. That's what I've done for my cats. You don't have to buy something that's got a picture of a cat on it. You're going to spend a fortune. Think outside the box and get some of these other things that are less expensive that your cat's going to like better.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Michelle in Madison, we turn to you now. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
I have a young, almost year-old border collie who does not have a weight problem. She's about 25 pounds full-grown, and I have a question about tick control. She's had at least a dozen ticks already. She's on frontline and has been for 2 months. And when I pull the ticks off, they seem to be deflated, but it's clear they've gotten blood out of her, but then by the time I find them, they're dead.
Yeah. And that's the joy of tick control. Fleas and ticks are totally different species. When you look at fleas and a flea jumps on board, they run through the hair coat and they will, run all through the hair coat and pick up lots of chemical. Frontline goes down into the hair follicles and then coats the hair as it's coming up. And so they're going to have more contact and die faster. Ticks, on the other hand, their biological behavior is as soon as they come in contact with an animal, they just stop and say, feed here. And so the only hair that has the chemical on that they're coming in contact with is in the immediate surroundings. So it takes longer for them to pick up enough chemical to die. Thus, the new product that came out, Frontline, the Mariel company came out with a new kind of improved Frontline, and they don't want to call it Frontline Plus Plus, so they renamed it. It's called Certifect. It's got a very small amount of a chemical called ametraz in it. Ametraz is an excellent tick killer at really high levels, but it stinks and it's got lots of issues with it, if, you know, with, you know, especially with, you know, human contact and so on. This is a smidgen, not enough to kill ticks, but what it does is it makes them behave like fleas. They end up running through the hair coat and picking up more chemical, so they die faster before they have a chance to attach. So it sounds like, you know, your dog is spending a lot of time in heavy tick areas.
She's a sheep herder.
It's expected that she's going to be getting, you know, exposed to that grass that's about a foot tall that has all the ticks on it. So you may want to talk to your veterinarian about getting a prescription for this product called CertiFect. Save the front line for the summer when ticks are at a lull, and use CertiFect in the spring and fall. We had ticks in January in this area. So, yeah.
So they're
bad this year.
Would it make sense to use the CertiFect on her at this point as we go into summer, or should I just...
You may want to use it for the next month or two because the ticks are going to be out. But once it gets to be really hot, then the ticks tend to peter out a little bit. They may still be there, but there's going to be much lower numbers, and then start again in the fall.
And go back to the CertiFect in the fall.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine here at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're like me, the animals that are part of your family are very important to you, and you want to keep them healthy and happy, of course. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today here on the Ideas Network. Glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine with us for the next half hour to share information about your pet's health. So whether you're a lifelong dog owner or maybe you can't imagine life without your kitty on your lap, Sandy is ready to answer your questions about your pet's health when you call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. Or I hope you'll really hope you'll go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show for updates and photos. Please post photos of your pets. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She's one of our regulars, comes by every month to talk with you and with me and to answer your questions. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@WPR.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Ryan in Wausau has been waiting quite a while, so let's go there. Hi, Ryan. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, hi. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
I have a 13-year-old cat, and last time she was in at the dentist, they said that she had a mild to medium amount of calculus on her teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But basically that was it, though, and they're trying a drinking additive for a while to see if that helps. I don't know if that will. And she also has a heart murmur, so they said if they clean the teeth that they'd recommend, you know, various scans and everything else, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, at what point do you think teeth really need to be cleaned?
Well, you know, I think they need to be cleaned from the day you get your pet. That's the easiest answer. And they, you know, ideally brushing is something that needs to be done, but an older cat that may have some pre-existing disease, putting a toothbrush in there may turn them off of having it done, especially if they've got some gingivitis and it's uncomfortable. So don't just say, well, I'm going to start brushing your teeth. But when one of our veterinary dentists at the vet school has what he calls his pyramid of oral health care. And so it's kind of like the food pyramid, but this is, you know, looking at, you know, what works for the mouth. Number one is brushing. Number two would be using things that are like dental diets and dental chews and things like that. And then way down at the bottom are things like water additives. They tend to not work very well, although, you know, it sounds really easy. Just put it in the water. There, you know, can be a problem. In fact, there's one that's available for veterinary, you know, for veterinarians to prescribe to people that, believe it or not, has xylitol in it, which for dogs is, you know, you've got a cat, but for dogs can be toxic. So if it's not mixed correctly, it could result in the dog developing hypoglycemia and liver disease and so on. So it's, you know, that just shows you, you know, it's not even, that one isn't even safe to use if it's mixed incorrectly. So it's a good question. You know, you have to weigh out the risk of anesthesia versus the benefit the cat's going to get from its, you know, having its teeth taken care of. We know that periodontal disease, one, can be painful. Most cats and dogs aren't going to show their pain, though. They're going to maybe show it in very subtle ways, but probably nothing that you're going to pick up on. But it also acts as a source of infection for other places in the body, such as diseased heart valves, if that's why your cat has a heart murmur, the kidneys, the liver, and the lungs, and so on. So, boy, it's, you know, it's one of those things where I have just the same dilemma that you're going through when I have a patient sitting in front of me. Do we, don't we? And so I, you know, I think trying things, if your cat doesn't have to be on a special diet and there's not a lot of oral disease going on, you may want to up the ante and go to one of the dental diets like TD or Science Diet Oral Care. Royal Canin makes an oral care product as well. And, you know, giving that a try. You may want to try introducing a toothbrush if the mouth isn't that painful. But your veterinarian's right. Anesthetizing a cat with a heart murmur requires at minimum would be a chest x-ray to see if there's any indication of failure. And ideally, we'd probably end up getting an echocardiogram to see what's going on and what's causing the murmur so that we have a better handle on doing the right thing anesthesia-wise.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Mark in Columbus, your turn. Hello.
Hello. How are you? Good afternoon.
Hello.
My question is in regards to dewormers for my dogs.
Uh-huh.
My dog's on HeartGuard 12 months out of the year, and I understand the importance of that. It's also my understanding that HeartGuard is a good general dewormer, and I'm wondering if they are on a dewormer for 12 months out of the year, how important is it that we do the fecal annually? Because aren't we just testing for a condition that I'm already treating?
Oh, that's a really good question. And in fact, I just had this exactly the same one from one of my clients this morning.
Oh.
And my answer to them was that the only, if you're using HeartGuard, the only two parasites that are picked up and treated by the pyrantel in HeartGuard, because the level of ivermectin we're using is not high enough to get any other intestinal parasites at off-label uses at, let's say, 50 times the level we're using it for heartworm preventative, then you might be able to get some other parasites. But the pyrantel will get roundworms and hookworms. And I'm probably going to be maybe talking a little over your head or other people's head, maybe not. But parasites have what's called a pre-patency period. And that means from when the pet gets infected till we can detect it in the poop sample. And for roundworms and hookworms, it's less than 30 days. So that even though we are once a month cleaning your dog's intestinal tract out of those two particular parasites, by the end of the month, if the dog was, you know, exposed 2 days, a day later by, you know, walking through some contaminated soil, they may be shedding them again. So checking a stool sample, sometimes when we've got dogs on heartworm preventative, it's really important to do it just prior to them receiving their next dose of heartworm preventative. So, you know, here's a classic example. You are thinking you've got this sense of security. My dog doesn't have parasites. I'm letting them poop in my backyard. I have kids. It's summertime. I'm a little lax about picking it up because it's raining out and the poop got washed into the grass. And your dog happens to have hookworms. Your kids go out and play in the backyard, and lo and behold, they develop cutaneous larval migraines because these little larvae will penetrate through our skin too and cause problems. So that's one of the reasons why we do it. They may still be getting exposed and we could have it, and it could make a difference with how you work with your yard, picking up stool and so on. So it's the public health significance for doing it. And the other reason is that's just two of many, many, many parasites that dogs get. There's a great website that I go to almost on a daily basis called the Companion Animal Parasite Council. It's called capcvet.org. But if you go there, there's actually a spot for pet owners to go to, but it's a great spot for veterinarians. And when we start looking at other intestinal parasites that dogs can get, they can get strongyloides, they can get whipworms, they can get coccidia, they can get giardia. There's lots of other ones, and those are all very important for the dog's health as well. So that's why we recommend checking a stool sample. And actually, their recommendation is to do it, you know, probably twice a year would be ideal, especially in heavy areas of the country where parasites are a really heavy common problem, such as down south.
There you go, Mark. Thank you for calling. Tony in Cloquet, Minnesota. Hello to you.
Hi, Dr. Sandy. How
Hello.
Are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you.
First-time caller, long-time listener.
Okay.
You're hard to get through to sometimes, but thank God.
Uh-huh.
It's not so much a question as you were talking last year about hip dysplasia on dogs. Well, mm-hmm. I wanted to get through during that time because my young Siberian Husky at 6 months old, we found out that she had hip dysplasia in both hips.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I bred my dogs, and I got the mom and dad, and I kept two of the kids. And right away, I put health insurance on them, and I do have a good health insurance, so it wasn't a problem for me. But anybody out there who's concerned about the TPO surgery, I would recommend it.
Okay.
It's a lot of work, but boy, was it well worth it.
Yeah.
Especially if you have the insurance.
Right. There's, you know, and again, that's what that surgery is a triple pelvic osteotomy. It's where they actually cut the pelvis in three places and realign it so that the hips actually sit deeper in the socket. Hip dysplasia is a problem where the hip socket is too shallow, and the hip bone actually moves around, and eventually you get cartilage damage and arthritis and pain. Part of being a responsible pet owner is knowing what you're getting into when you're adopting a dog. And in fact, the AVMA has just published a thing called Guidelines for Responsible Pet Ownership. And the first thing they said is that avoid impulsive decisions without obtaining all the pertinent information and carefully selecting the pet that would be appropriate for you. And that pertinent information is knowing what genetic diseases to be looking for. And so, you know, doing your homework. And there's even a website now that is really easy to navigate. It's called the Canine Inherited Disorders Database. That if you're contemplating, like in your case, getting another husky, you can go on there and say, okay, what kind of health problems do these guys have? What's genetic? And these are the things that I need to be making sure that the mom and dad have been screened for. And actually ask to see written proof. I can't tell you how often people say, oh, no, we've never seen hip dysplasia in our line. Well, you know, that's not good enough. I want to actually see what mom and dad's hips are like. And there's various registration services where you can get that done. So I'm glad it worked out well for your dog. And I'm very grateful that you've got pet health insurance. That is one of the things that you can do to help save a lot of money. In fact, you know, pet ownership doesn't have to take a big bite out of your budget if you budget appropriately and do things like buy pet insurance. So
there you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Tony. Yeah, appreciate the call. Michael in Stratford, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Say, I want to get a second opinion here in the end, but I can give you a little information about my dog. I have a four-year-old Shih Tzu, and my wife was walking her the other day on quite a long leash, and we live out in the country, she likes to grab things wherever she can find them. My wife's seen her grab something and chew it down real quick. We don't know what it was. Well, the next morning, she was throwing up quite severely, pretty much all day long throwing up, had diarrhea, and her diarrhea looked like it real dark and not much at a time. And then we had some probiotics, so we mixed some probiotics and gave her some boiled hamburger and rice. She started to get better, but we noticed in her stool it's like a mucus in with it, and just small amounts. She doesn't defecate just a whole amount,
mm-hmm.
just a small amounts. So I called my local veterinarian, and she said, bring a sample in. So I took that in today, and she says, it looks like it's colitis. And she tested for worms. She says, there's no worms or anything. And she didn't want to put her on an antibiotic. Well, then I come home. My wife says, no, I think it's been 4 days here. We better get her on an antibiotic. Now, she is looking better.
Okay.
But I was just wondering, the vet, then I went in and got an antibiotic, and it's amoxicillin.
Okay.
And I was just wondering if that is an appropriate or strong enough medicine for this.
I have no idea why they prescribed amoxicillin. That would be absolutely useless for what you're dealing with. But, yeah, so I think, I'll back up a little bit. As veterinarians, whenever we have a patient come in with gastrointestinal problems that are resulting in diarrhea, we have to kind of ask pertinent questions, and yes, we look at poop a lot to try to find out, is this small bowel diarrhea or large bowel diarrhea, meaning down in the large intestine and colon. And there's different things that show up for the different types of diarrhea. And typically when we've got a colitis or a large bowel diarrhea, you're going to see mucus, because that's where the mucus glands are, is down there. As soon as a little bit of stool gets in there, the dog's going to try to push it out because they're inflamed and it hurts. And so you'll just see a lot of straining and tiny bits of poop coming out. You may see frank blood as well. And so I teach my students what I call the five F's of colitis. And the five F's of colitis, and actually probably should be six, are the first thing you do is you put a finger up there. Did your dog eat something that is stuck down there, like a mouse carcass or something that's just really irritating? And so that's one thing you can do, is go in there with a finger. Number two is run a fecal. And running a stool sample for parasites, the most common parasite that can cause colitis in dogs is one called whipworms. And unfortunately, they don't always shed their eggs in the feces. But if we get a positive fecal back, we do a little dance around and go, yay, we got our answer. If we get a negative one back, it doesn't rule out parasites. So I will often put these dogs on a broad-spectrum dewormer, usually one called, guess what, it starts with an F, fenbendazole. So finger fecal, fenbendazole, which is goes by the brand name of Panacure. The next thing we do is, because the colon is usually very irritated, and we may sometimes have some bacterial overgrowth of various like anaerobic bacteria and so on, we will use an antibiotic that's called a Flagyl. Goes, that's the brand name, but metronidazole. But I have to stick with the F, so you know, there's Flagyl. And so that would be, for colitis, probably a more appropriate antibiotic, but it also has anti-inflammatory effects and anti-protozoal effects. It will get another parasite, somewhat not very effective, called Giardia. So we'll put them on that. And then the last F, well, close to the last F, is food. When we've got a dog with colitis, you were right on with going with like a boiled rice and boiled chicken dinner. But so a low residue diet that's easy to digest, so they don't have a lot of stool going down there, and that gives the colon a rest. So we do that for a few days. And then the other F, there just happens to be a brand of a probiotic called Fortiflora, so it fits in with my F theme. And so we'll put the dog on Fortiflora as well. So I think the amoxicillin has a greater chance of upsetting your dog's stomach, and it would be inappropriate for most infections if there is an infection that we're going to see in the intestinal tract. So back to the drawing board again.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. I have an email from Debbie, who has a 15-year-old lab shepherd mix. I believe she has muscle atrophy and has lost 10 pounds over the last year. Weight went from 52 to 42 pounds. Is that a normal amount for weight loss due to muscle atrophy? She has weepy eyes and hungry all the time. She's on a Proen?
Yeah, that's because she's probably got a urinary tract issue with some incontinence.
Some very light steroids for allergies.
Yeah, so that is a significant weight loss. 10 pounds doesn't sound like a whole lot, but when you actually look at the weight of the dog, that's a 20% weight loss. And boy, my doctor would love to see me lose that, by the way.
Me too.
But yeah. But no, that is significant. And so find out, I mean, if she's hungry all the time, it may be the steroids that she's on for her allergies, but it could be something else. Is she now a diabetic or something else? So getting her in and having that looked at would be not a bad idea. I mean, dogs will lose muscle if they don't use their muscles. And that's why we always recommend, for dogs with arthritis, part of our, we call it our WEDDS program, is weight control, It stands for the W. E is exercise, okay? But you have to moderate exercise. So in a 15-year-old dog, obviously going for long walks is out of the question. But perhaps going to one of those doggy pools that they have now, these like fitness centers for dogs, or now that it's warmer enough, take them down to the lake and let them have that buoyancy of the water to move their legs around. Working with a physical therapist to have some guidance as to what things you can do with, you know, passive movement and helping with balance and things. The other things that are part of the, you know, dealing with arthritis is diet, various drugs and things for pain control. So if your dog isn't getting up and is healthy and happy lab work-wise, perhaps pain control will get your dog up and moving a little bit better. And then obviously supplements too is the S. That's our WEDDS program. So
there you go.
I think that's significant. I'd say get it checked out.
Judy sent a really cool post on our Facebook page of what kind of dog is
that
a really
looks
cutie?
Like a chin, a Japanese chin, I would believe.
Oh,
so
beautiful dog.
And if I'm wrong, oh, I'm in trouble.
We had another Facebook question, too. Our lab mix has developed an old 12-year-old, developed arthritis in his back, slowly crushing his spine. Vet says, use it or lose it, and I should let him walk as far as he wants. He wants to walk 15 to 20 miles on the weekend. We do about 4 miles a day on weekdays, which was his old habit. But he really can only go about 6 before he becomes tired. Am I doing more harm than good by letting him walk 8 to 10 miles with frequent stops after mile 6?
Oh, boy. You know, and this is where we have to sometimes be the brains of the dog. I would like to know how this dog is feeling the next day. If they are unable to get up and are stiff and sore.
He's usually rather stiff and sore for 2 days.
2 days, yeah. So I think we need to sometimes be the brains of the dog and say, you know what, as much as you want to walk, let's do shorter, more frequent walks. Or maybe, like I talked to, you know, the person that emailed before, think of other ways of exercising your dog, such as swimming. Water aerobics is wonderful for these older dogs with back and joint problems. So, I think that exercise is important. I totally agree with the veterinarian that, you know, use it or lose it type thing. But obviously moderation. You're not going to, you know, see my grandmother out, you know, jogging. Maybe if she did it years ago, but she might be able to do chair aerobics or, you know, jump in a pool and have some floaties around her and exercise that way.
A bunch of photos, too, that are really cool. I hope you go to our Facebook page. There's quite a few photos there of dogs that people have. We have Jim who emailed who has two dogs. A Brittany Spaniel and a Husky. Spaniel got Lyme disease in March, giving the vaccine to the Husky. There's another disease that's coming on the radar, leptospirosis, or lepto as it's usually called. Should they be vaccinated for lepto?
Well, this is something to discuss with the veterinarian. We do know that leptospirosis is spread through primarily urine of wildlife, raccoons, deer, and so on. And so raccoons, even in Madison now, they're very urbanized. They live in our sewer systems. They come up and they use our decks as latrines. They're in our trash. And so our pets are going to be able to get exposed to this. Lepto is a treatable disease, but it's not a nice treatment. It can cause kidney failure and liver failure. And so if they're around wet areas, if they're around wildlife, definitely get them vaccinated for it.
Lou in Milwaukee wonders, he has a 5-month-old puppy going on a trip to the UP for the weekend. Forgot to ask about Lyme disease vaccination. Is she too young for it or should I...
Not
bother for such a short
not
trip.
Not too young, but too late to be thinking about it. It takes two doses, two to 4 weeks apart. So can't get it done.
All right. So, boy, we've gone through a lot today.
I know we have. And I'm going to be back next month, second Tuesday of the month. And I've got a whole bunch more that we can talk about that we never even got a chance to.
Yeah, we've got enough time just to mention the microchips. I know they can be a real lifesaver when a pet gets lost, but are they affected if a pet goes through an MRI machine?
Not at all.
Oh, okay.
Perfectly safe. They actually did a study, and they still work, and they're not going to cause any trouble during the MRI. So,
okay.
Not a scare for having that implanted into your pet.
Well, and you are back on the second Tuesday of the month, as always, so you'll be May 8th.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Sandy.
You are welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Vet Medicine, our guest today. She will be back on Tuesday, May 8th. And just taking a look at tomorrow at 11, we'll be talking with Jerry Legarry about raptor migration. That's at 11 o'clock. And then at 11:45, Gary Engberg will be here with a fishing report. Have you been out? How's it been? We'll look forward to hearing what Gary's got to say as the getting closer to the opening, the regular opening of the fishing season. And don't forget, if you want to check out my trip to London, you could come along with us. Go to WPR.org/trip, and you'll find out some more information about it. It's July 1st through the 9th. Going to be a lot of fun. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.